This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. It's been 9 days since the tsunami devastated Southeast Asia. As the death toll rises, so does the number of survivor stories. One of those is the story of the Hall family. Originally from Asheboro, the family had decided to gather in Thailand for a mid-December vacation. After reaching a resort in Koh Lanta Island, the Halls exchanged gifts and sang carols on Christmas Day. After a walk on the beach the next morning, the Halls were relaxing in their hotel room, and then, without warning, came the world's worst natural disaster in 40 years. Christina Hall, who lives in Cary and works at the Kings Park International Church in Durham, was one of the family members there that day. She is now back in North Carolina and joins us in the studio. I'm glad to see you and that you are with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
When you first saw that tsunami 9 days ago, what did you think it was?
Well, originally we were in our rooms and we just heard water rushing. We were on the second story, and so we heard people screaming and thought it was a game. And my brother ran out onto the balcony and said, "Oh my gosh, you have to get out here and see this." And we thought it was a flood. We thought a dam had broken, as ridiculous as that sounds to have a dam in the ocean. But that was the only thing we had to relate to it.
Right. And so the water just comes rushing to you. Did it cover your hotel?
The restaurant and the bar of the hotel were actually, just submerged. The hotel itself, the first floor had about 3 or 4 feet of water just rush in. We were on the second floor. Mm-hmm. And the bungalows that were lining the hotel were actually about 5 feet off the ground anyways. So they didn't have any water damage. The first floor was what filled up the quickest. Probably at the highest point was like 3 feet of water in the hotel, and then it rushed out quickly.
Now, was this hotel right at the sea level, or
there was a slight incline on the beach, but we were on the sand.
Yeah. And did the water stick around for a long time?
Oh, it took probably about 5 or 6 hours for all of the standing water to eventually drain off. The roads cleared after about 2 or 3. The main road cleared. But it took about 5 or 6 hours. And even the next morning, in some places, there was still standing water around the hotel.
Mm. Yeah. So this was a tourist area, obviously, because that's what you were there as.
Yes.
And as that tragedy unfolded, there lots of people were pitching in.
Right. Basically, all we could do once the water hit, we ran downstairs to see what was going on, and immediately injured people came into the hotel. And so we didn't even make it downstairs before we turned around, ran upstairs, grabbed our towels, clean water. I grabbed a bottle of Listerine, didn't have anything else, and so started cleaning out wounds. People had deep gashes filled with sand and pebbles, and that was during the first round of waves. And then we were forced out of the hotel by the management and by our own will to get to higher ground. And as we were rushing and running through about 2.5 feet of water, we managed to make it to a dry place. And then as people just kept coming, everyone was injured, it seemed like. My family was really very fortunate. We had clothes on, not just a bathing suit, and we weren't hurt.
Right. So you did this for hours, administering first aid, and this is not your background.
No. I'm an administrator, but not a first aid administrator. my mom and another lady administered first aid for about 2 hours. And then I was in between that and running back and getting clean water, and all this without shoes, just running through the muck and who knew what was in the water, getting clean water, towels, anything we could. At one point, I ran into a German guy I had met on the beach, and he had a first aid kit, which he gave to me, and it really looked just like a travel first aid kit, but somehow we managed to bandage about 50 people with the things that were in there. Mm. And I continued on after they stopped administering first aid for about 4 more hours with a couple of German paramedics. Mm. And so just helping people get to higher ground, consoling people. There were so many people in shock. We had one older man that most likely died on the way to the hospital, and his son, I didn't hold much hope for him either. He had massive internal and head injuries.
Wow. So you also had a story, I understand, of some heroics by the man who ran the restaurant.
Yes.
There.
There was a restaurant on the beach, and there was a British lady and her sister and husband, her brother-in-law had been coming for about 10 years. And when the first wave came in, they were washed out. And they didn't realize what had happened, so they just went back to the restaurant. And the restaurant had been set back a little bit, but when the second round of waves came, everything was washed out, and the Thai people actually grabbed a hold of them, because this British lady was 72 years old. And the Thai men grabbed a hold of them and just held on so they wouldn't get washed out. And when we saw after the aftermath of that, we actually didn't realize what was going on, but we saw people digging out from underneath what looked just like debris. And it turned out that the restaurant actually collapsed on them. And so we got a picture of this lady being helped out, and she ended up being our primary person that we were taking care of. She had serious heart problems and was in just utter shock, hysterical. And the Thai man that I mentioned, the one man that most likely died and his son, were actually those two men that held on to them. And right. And essentially, if they did pass away, gave their lives. So
indeed. So you were there administering literally the first aid.
Yeah.
Did you see, and how long did you stay in Thailand after this?
We actually weren't able to get to our hotels to stay there at all that night. We stayed overnight out on this, it was like a construction zone that they had cleared for a new hotel that was going to be built on the side of a mountain. And there were probably 50 of us by the end of the evening. We just built bonfires and stayed out all night. And around 6 in the morning when the sun came up, we were on our last piece of firewood and were able to go back down to the hotel. And then about 10 o'clock the next morning, we had another warning of a wave. And that had been happening all night, which was the reason why we didn't go back down to the hotel. There was warning after warning that waves were coming. And
But none of them panned out.
None of them were bigger than the ones that were initially. They were just kind of the aftershocks or the after effects of the aftershocks of the earthquake. And so around 10 o'clock, we were able to find a Thai family that had a truck. And so my brothers and my father and I sat in the back of a truck with our luggage, and my mom and my sister-in-law and their one-year-old sat in the front cab, and we rode for 4 hours in the heat, hadn't showered, were disgusting until we got to Krabi. And Krabi was the main place they were taking people initially. And then we stayed overnight there in a very humble Thai hotel, but it had air conditioning, hot water, and cable, and that's all we cared about.
That has to be jarring, though, to go from that scene of just devastation to, the comforts of a regular old vacation place.
It was amazing. I don't think any of us cried until we got to the place where we were in a safe place. And in fact, the hotel that we ended up staying at was actually right along a canal. And when we walked out to go check internet for the first time, there was a big boat up on the side of a small island in the middle of the canal. And we just couldn't believe this huge ship was just there, was marooned. So
it had been forced in on a wave.
Yeah.
Speaking of the internet, have you been keeping up with this story? Because you are one of the people that was there when it hit, and I wonder if is enough enough? You've seen the pictures?
Yeah, it has actually been really hard to watch the news. When I made it back to the States, my fiancé and his family wouldn't let me watch the news because it was too much. And even last night, trying to watch the news, I couldn't. I had to settle for just Entertainment Tonight and Inside Edition because I couldn't handle real news.
I understand your family had originally booked a hotel on a different beach.
Yes.
That hotel got pounded.
Yes.
Destroyed.
It was. There are several beaches on Koh Lanta, and we picked a beach that we thought was nice, ended up not liking it as soon as we got there, and just were unsatisfied. And so my parents, for the first time in my life, decided to change hotels. And we're very thankful. It was a miracle.
What made you change?
My mom was unhappy, and my sister-in-law said, I just don't feel right about this. And so my parents said, okay, let's move. And we later found out that beach, because it was so shallow, because it was so flat, the hotels were just utterly destroyed. There was no higher ground to run to there.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think you'll return to Thailand?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had you been there before?
I've been. My parents have been twice. This was my second time. It was a beautiful vacation until then. And how many times does this happen in our lifetime? So I will definitely go back. The Thai people had did nothing but serve. Even after the devastation, they brought food. They stayed up all night cooking and building fires for people. So, Thailand is a paradise. It's great.
Well, Christina Hall, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christina Hall lives in Cary. She works at Kings Park International Church in Durham, and she was in Thailand when the tsunami hit 9 days ago. For information on tsunami disaster relief efforts, how you can contribute to that, and to see some of the photos that Christina has been talking about here, you can go to our website at wunc.org. Now, a while back, author Alan Gurganis joined us here on The State of Things, and in one short passage, he laid out the diversity of accents to be found here in North Carolina.
When I was growing up, we used to be able to tell on the third syllable whether you were from Wilmington or Asheville or any stuff in between. It has to do with the sort of inherent humidity of the language. Mountain talk is up in the sinus passages, and as you get east and as you get more willfully aristocratic, it drops and it becomes wispier and the syllables blend and the consonants go absolutely nowhere and it's pure vowel.
Well, just ahead on The State of Things, we will talk more about the way we talk. North Carolina State linguistics expert Walt Wolfram joins us to talk about the new documentary, Voices of North Carolina. And we'll be taking your calls, no matter what your accent. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. All of that ahead on The State of Things. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn Cava. Linguist Walt Wolfram has spent a career tracing the lilts and twangs of North Carolina speech. He says there is more diversity in North Carolina's accents than there is in the entire American West. And one explanation could be the geographic isolation in pockets of North Carolina. That same isolation also gave rise to the traditional music and the storytelling in our state. But there are other explanations, one of them cultural pride. And contrary to what you might think, some accents are actually getting stronger, not weaker, in North Carolina. The state's accents are the subject of a new documentary produced by Walt Wolfram. It's called Voices of North Carolina. We'll be airing shortly. And Walt Wolfram is with us in the studio to talk about it and the accents in our state this hour. Welcome, Walt.
And thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're also taking your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Is there something unique about the way you speak or those around you do? And what is the strangest accent you've heard here in North Carolina? We'd like to know. What is the strangest accent you've heard, Walt?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call them strange, okay. but certainly there are some of the most distinctive accents. I guess dialectologists are allowed to have favorites, and I happen to like Outer Banks speech quite a bit myself because I've spent a lot of time there, and it's old, it's quaint, and it's pretty distinct. So that's, but I love them all, really. There isn't an accent that I don't like.
Well, you speak of the Outer Banks, and why don't we have a clip from your documentary. We have several that we'll play this hour. Why don't we hear right now, this I believe is Mr. Rex O'Neill from
right.
Ocracoke Island, and he's describing the Hoytoider accent.
Right.
Hoytoid? What is it? It's Hoytoid. It's high tide. It's when the tide comes up high, you know. On the sand side, sand, like Pamlico sand. This is the Pamlico sand. Hoytoid on the sand side.
There's Rex O'Neill in Walt Wolfram's documentary, Voices of North Carolina. So we have that hoytoid accent, and this is something that the original settlers on Ocracoke, the white
settlers.
Yeah,
we think that they brought it with them. I mean, it's hard to go back because you're talking about the early 1700s, but for the most part, we think that it was brought there but also has developed since that time. Mm.
Are there places, this would have been, the settlers there would have been from the United Kingdom, from
well,
England?
No, they would have come down from Virginia, from Jamestown and so forth.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. But originally, can we trace this back to places in England?
Southwest England, probably. It has more affinity in Southwest England. As a matter of fact, at one point, we sent a tape to some native Brits, and they listened to it, and these were all Outer Banks people, and every one of them, of the 15 natives of England said that they were from Southwest England. They didn't even realize they were American.
Mm. Wow. So what is it? We're talking about the way people talk this hour, and we'll use the words accents and dialects, but I'm sure that as the expert on this, there are distinctions to be made there, aren't there?
Well, of course, there are lots of distinctions, but basically we're talking about pronunciation differences, like you heard on the tape, hoitoid, you know, mm-hmm. or saying for sound, pronunciation, and then there are grammatical differences. So, for example, in the Outer Banks, I say, I weren't there for, I wasn't, which they also use in England as well, quite frequently. And then there are, of course, vocabulary items, lexical items. So it seems like lots of communities have distinct lexical items that differentiate them from outsiders. So on Ocracoke, for example, outsiders are dingbatters. Or more recently, among the younger children, our youth, they're called Turons, a blend of tourist and moron, which is pretty creative with language, you have to admit.
Oh, I was amused to hear one time, I think it was Harker's Island people would refer to those from off the island as dit-dotters.
Dit-dots, right. Uh-huh.
And the explanation would be that they had to explain their language so much they felt like they were talking in Morse.
You want us to use telegraph.
Like Morse code.
Yeah, Morse code.
1-877-962-9862 is our number if you want to join the conversation. Let's go to Karma, who is in Plymouth. Hi there, Karma.
Hi. This is such a great topic. I'm really excited about this. I just called. I have a great uncle. Actually, my grandfather and his brothers are from Hyde County.
Uh-huh.
And, how now, Brown Cow. And they were in the Merchant Marines in the Second World War. And my uncle Thurston was on a ship, and they were going up the Thames River. And the captain was having a hard time understanding the guys who were trying to navigate them up the river, the British guys. And they said, well, how about that guy? You know, he's from Eastern North Carolina. Can't, you know, he kind of talks like them. So they got him up there, and he was able to sort of translate this English, and they could understand him, and he could understand them. So I just grew up with that and think it's really neat. Like this topic. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Karma.
Well, that's a really interesting observation, because the fact of the matter is that British speakers tend to have a little easier time deciphering Outer Banks speech sometimes than mainlanders. And that's because some of the features are, in fact, found in British English and are carryovers. So that doesn't surprise me. And, of course, Hyde County, you know, because of its isolation and its history and so forth, is part of that whole Outer Banks, what we refer to as the Pamlico Sound dialect.
Now, but what about in the western part of the state? Because I've heard it said for years, and you can truth squad this for me, that the talk of the speech patterns of those in the mountains of Appalachia is close to, I don't know, 16th or 17th century British English.
Well,
is that fact or fiction?
More fiction than fact, but a little fact. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are retentions from older English. But, of course, languages continually change. And so what it was 300 years ago, it is not today. It's a nice romantic myth that people like to believe and helps with identity. But, of course, it's changing. At the same time, you know, there is important Scots-Irish influence that has persisted. And that's persisted for a couple of centuries there.
1-877-962-9862 is our number if you want to join the conversation. We're talking with Walt Wolfram, who is behind this new documentary that's going to air in a few nights on public TV.
On Thursday.
On Thursday night on public TV here in North Carolina. It is called Voices of North Carolina. We're talking about the accents and dialects here in the state. So are we losing the accents? Do you think of them as a one lost thing, or is it ever
evolving? Well,
they're
certainly changing, and I think you probably hit on it. They're more evolving. I mean, the youth of, say, for the Outer Banks or in the mountains today are not like their elders, but they are still somewhat distinctive. And in some cases, we see some acceleration of differences. So it's not like they will die out, they will be transformed, but to the extent that these communities view themselves as distinct communities, as cultures, and as regional places, I think that they'll persist. Dialects are alive and well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because one hears of the mass media, because, right. you know, television getting into all places that used to be isolated where maybe a television signal couldn't get.
Yeah.
Because I did notice in watching your documentary the other day that a lot of the people who appeared in it were in their 40s and 50s. Right. There might have been somebody in her
30s. Yeah.
But we're talking, but the younger generation in their teens.
Yeah, that's true in some cases, and in some cases it's not so true. So, for example, in the African-American community, it's some of the younger speakers who are perpetuating the dialect more than the older speakers, who are becoming more urban African-American. And so in a sense, there are radical changes, but there's also persistence of these varieties.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about in the African-American community, because we have a clip here, and this has, we hear two people here talking about the variety mm-hmm. of what you can hear among African-Americans in North Carolina.
I play a game when I'm working with students. I ask them to lower their eyes for a second and pretend they can't.
I'm sorry, apparently we have the wrong clip there. We're going to be hearing that later. But nonetheless, there is the great diversity.
Yeah, there's actually older African Americans tended to be much more regional. So, for mm-hmm. example, in Hyde County or in the mountains of the Smoky Mountains, where there are a few small African American communities, basically the older speakers sounded like their white cohorts. But actually what has been taking place is the urbanization of African American speech has made it a little more homogenous, so that the youth today in some of these rural areas now sound more like the youth in urban areas. So Raleigh and Hyde County may not be as different today as they were, say, 50 or 100 years ago.
Okay, well, we now have the right clip for that. Let's hear that here.
They'd say, honey child, because I would always, it's just a part of my language, honey child, because I talk just like the people at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountain with that kind of twang and that kind of thing. And so that was just a part of me.
I have noticed this. Every click has their own lingo. Every click. It can change from a click standpoint to a state standpoint to a region standpoint. You see what I'm saying? We might say stuff in North Carolina that people in Georgia might not say, but there may be things that people in North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia would say all together. See what I'm saying?
There we hear Bertha Maxwell and Ninth Wonder.
Right. So you see the contrast in generations, too. Mm-hmm. So we see an older Charlotte speaker and then a younger speaker who's much more urban in his variety, which is, you know, it may be part of identity in terms of how African-American youth want to be identified at this point in time.
Okay. Let's go to Susan, who's on the Outer Banks. Hi, Susan.
Oh, hey.
Hi, welcome to the program. Did you have a question for Walt Wolfram?
No, I just want to tell you about my grandmother. She's from Kings Mountain, and she had words like John for join and pond for point. And step-ins, that was panties, counterpin, things that, you know, I grew up in Greensboro, and I always had to have an interpreter to help me with her. I'm really excited about this topic. I'm glad you're doing it. I've always been interested.
You bring up the excitement, and one of the things that we found is that language is something we both take for granted, but don't. So we don't talk about it a lot. And then when it's brought to our attention, we say, oh, yeah, it's really interesting. And one of the things we're trying to do in programs like this is to get North Carolinians to understand how language is a part of their cultural heritage, such as other sort of implements of culture, whether it's storytelling, whether it's music, that the way people speak is as much or more a part of North Carolina cultural heritage as any other artifact of culture that we might think of.
Mm-hmm. Well, Susan, I have a question for you. You say you grew up in Greensboro. Your grandmother's from the western part of the state. You live, I take it you're in the Outer Banks right now.
Right.
Do you think you have an accent?
I'm not sure what mine is. I was going to see if he could pick it out, but now you've already told him. But I lived in Florida where the northerners lived for a while. And when I came back to visit my parents after living around a lot of Yankees, they sounded very strange to me, and I think I picked up some of their dialect that now I'm pretty southern sounding, I guess.
You're pretty southern sounding.
Yeah.
Your vowels are pretty southern. You know, you have classic southern time for time and so forth. And a vowel like in boot sounds more like boot, which is pretty southern. So, yeah, you're pretty southern. And what, of course, happens to people is that people leave the area and they don't think they're very southern. And people say, boy, you sound very southern. And then when they come back, people say, boy, you don't sound very southern anymore. What's happened to you? So you're sort of in a catch-22. You can't please outsiders and you can't please the people back home. And you've probably experienced a little of that
right.
in the process.
I had a heck of a time trying to get oil in California for my car.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. Thanks so much. Well, this may be hard for people here to believe, but when I go to visit my folks in Connecticut, they claim that I have a southern accent. And I just, I know there's probably things that you shade in the way you speak. Sometimes, I call it sometimes, you know.
Well, what happens is you get a little accommodation, and you don't think or sound southern to people from the Raleigh area, but there are a few things you pick up. You know, and after a few years, it's hard not to say y'all.
It's protective color. Yeah. All right. Susan joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Susan.
Hi. My question concerned a word that came up in a restaurant a few nights ago. The word is toboggan.
Uh-huh.
In the north, people think that's a sled for sliding on the snow. And in the south,
you put it on your head.
A knitted hat.
Yeah.
Can you give us any clarification about that?
Well, I'm not sure I can clarify it other than say that you're absolutely right. It's one of those cases where the same term has quite diverse meanings. And I actually think that that the wrap around the head is the older form and the toboggan is a more recent one in terms of the sled.
How do you think that came about, that a hat would become a sled?
So. now that I don't know.
Is that not your line of work?
Well, it's my line of work, but etymology, every word has its own history.
Yeah.
And when you're dealing with 100,000 words, it's just hard to remember them all.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Susan. I hope that helped. Now, you talked about how we get dialects and manners of speaking because people have cultural identity. And a couple of the groups that you looked at in North Carolina, not just geographically apart, but also culturally apart, were two Native American tribes. First, let's hear about the Lumbee down Robeson County. And we have a clip here from Hayes Allen Locklear, who relates a story about going to church.
I went with a friend to church to see a Christmas play last year, and this white gentleman who was from Hamlet or Rockingham went with us, and he thought the preacher was speaking in tongues, and he was actually speaking in Lum.
Lum, that's just lingo, that's just belonging. When you say you're Lum, that's identity.
It's from the documentary Voices of North Carolina, which Walt Wolfram was part of and will be airing this week on public TV. So tell us about Lum.
Okay, Lum is kind of an insider term for someone who identifies with Lumbee culture. So, you know, I couldn't be a Lum, and Heather Locklear, who is Lumbee by ancestry, could not be a Lum. Because she's never lived there and never experienced the culture. But it also points to something deeper among the Lumbee, who lost their ancestral language generations ago, and we can only speculate as to what it actually was. That language among the Lumbee and their distinct dialect is one of their strongest symbols of who they are. As a matter of fact, in their original recognition by the federal government, in which they were recognized but without entitlements in 1955 or 56, I believe it was, it said that they are distinct by manner of speaking. And they weren't talking about a different language, they were talking about a different dialect. So dialect has been very important to the Lumbee in terms of identifying who they are.
And yet on the other end of the state, you have the Cherokee, the eastern band of the Cherokee in Cherokee, North Carolina. And here we have a man who is in Snowbird in the Cherokee Nation. And we hear him talking in both English and Cherokee.
My name is Cherokee language, Maga Awodagay. Nole Oxigunagda Daga, I'm all right. Nole Ngohila Digilakstan again. I worked all time. And that's Cherokee language, I guess. Shio Oxiwuja, Talina Dan Dagahon, I see you again.
Well, it's rather telling there that when I hear him speak Cherokee, I hear the cadence of his North Carolina, Southern English.
Right. There's an overlay of Appalachian English, Smoky Mountain English on the Cherokee. And when Cherokees speak in English, of course, it is very Appalachian English. But there's an interesting movement among the Cherokee in that there's a lot more Cherokee being taught in the schools, and a lot of the younger students are very interested in preserving their heritage. So there's a kind of renaissance in the Cherokee language as a part of Cherokee culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question would be whether those students are, when they're speaking English, which is their first language, mm-hmm. do they have as much of an accent as their parents do?
Well, they don't have much of a Cherokee accent. The question, of course, is when they speak Cherokee, they tend to sort of have an overlay of Appalachian speech. So I'm sure to an older native speaker of Cherokee, it sounds a little accented from English. But hey, the kids are learning, they're proud of it, and it's part of who they are becoming and what they want to preserve.
We are talking about accents and dialects here in North Carolina. If you want to join a conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. We'd love to hear yours. With us is Walt Wolfram, a linguist at NC State University. His new documentary about North Carolina accents is called Voices of North Carolina. You'll be able to see it on public TV Thursday this week. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking today about the diverse landscape of accents in North Carolina, from the islands of the Outer Banks to North Carolina's mountains. People speak in dialects that are sometimes incomprehensible to people on the other part of the state. Linguist Walt Wolfram celebrates that diversity. He's made it the subject of a new documentary, Voices of North Carolina, which airs on public TV this week. Walt Wolfram is here in the studio, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Howard is with us from Orange County. Hi there, Howard.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. We hear you fine.
Okay, thank you. I am a native of New Jersey, and I've lived here for about 14 years, and I have three children that are native of North Carolina. And I wanted to ask Dr. Whitman as far as what effect as far as children. I've noticed my sons, since they're school age now, developing certain words, you know, that they're pronouncing differently, although I've never pronounced them that way, and very simple words that we use all the time, but yet it seems like they're imprinting more on their schoolmates instead of their parents, and I just wanted to know about that. And they're also starting to teach it to my preschool daughter, and she's picking it up from them and not from us.
What word in particular is it?
Dad. They're saying dad.
Dad. Well, I have good and bad news for you. The good news is that kids actually don't talk like parents. We like to think that they do, but actually once they get old enough, they tend to accommodate their peers. And so the good news is also that she will talk like where she's from. And if you're from New Jersey, the chances are she's not, or your children are not going to have a strong Southern dialect. But it's impossible not to grow up in this area and hear lots of Southern vowels and acquire some of them. You know, and I realize that some Northerners don't like that and some Northerners do like that. But this is the reality that children tend not to speak like their parents. They speak the dialect of where they grow up because peer influence becomes so important, and they're the models for these children.
You know, I think after 20 years, I've started to pronounce the holiday in November as Thanksgiving. But I haven't yet said insurance. 1-877-962-9862 is number. And Renee is in Winston. Hi, Renee.
Hi, I'd like to find out where the pervasive notion came about that if you have a Southern accent, you're less intelligent than someone who lives in another part of the country.
That's a really good point. It's all about politics. It's and what happens is that if oppressed groups or socially subordinate groups tend to have that stigma attached to their dialect. So it's not, as a matter of fact, there's an interesting sort of turnaround on this. The British prefer Southern speech because it's more like theirs. And so it has more prestige in England than it does here. But of course, because of the northern-southern conflicts that we've had and because of the political dominance of the North, things southern, including speech, have carried a stigma. So it's all about politics.
Does that satisfy you, Renee?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call. We go to Linda in Pinehurst now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have two short questions. The first one is that my husband is from Robbins, North Carolina, in Moore County, just like John Edwards, and I was wondering what is the where did that come from, that speech? And second of all, I wanted to clarify it on the toboggan. I also lived in Maine for a while, and up there they call knit caps toboggan hats.
Okay. Yeah.
Hats that you would wear while you're on a toboggan, in other
Correct.
Words?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting, except I'm not quite sure how that explains it in the South, in some areas where they haven't had a lot of snow. But, you know.
There are the mountains in North Carolina. That, though. Well,
that's true. You know.
And we do get snow every once in a while.
Yeah. And actually, the John Edwards dialect is not all that distinctive among Southern varieties. It's a fairly general Southern Piedmont variety where there's a little ungliding of the I and things like time and so forth.
Right.
And the vowels. The vowel of a word like boot is more like boot. So it's pretty subtle, but obviously to people outside of the area who are looking very closely at these things, it becomes more distinctly Southern than it actually is in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So how is that different? Would John Edwards' manner of speaking be different from a person who grew up in Charlotte or Greensboro at all? Or is the Piedmont, is there a generic
there is a general Piedmont. I mean, within North Carolina, there are dialect differences. So, for example, to the western part of the state and to the East Coast, you get tad, but you also get, like for right, you get rat, where you don't get that so much in the Piedmont. And also in the eastern part of the state, you get more R-lessness historically, you know, fall for four, which is, of course, what older Raleigh and older Charlotte were originally.
I mean, dropping the R's.
Dropping the R's is something that was very common in older aristocratic Raleigh and older aristocratic Charlotte. It mm-hmm. was the high class, the prestigious way of speaking at that point.
And also, you know, the case of John Edwards, and Linda, if you're still there, I don't know if you want to weigh in on that. Is there that impact of maybe bumping up the accent a little bit when you're out making a speech to use for effect?
Oh, absolutely.
Because on the other hand, you have people who would try to lose their accents to get ahead in the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, accents can be very complex. They're not simple things, you know? So at one point, having an accent may be a bad thing. At another point, when it comes to identity and who you relate to and how you represent where you're from, it can be a very positive effect. And I think it was kind of interesting because in some ways, Edwards played better in the Midwest than in some parts of the South. And part of that may have been his Southern dialect, that this is a guy who has sort of common and ordinary roots and we can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, Linda, thank you for your call.
Well, thank you.
Okay. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Carrie is in Raleigh. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, welcome to the program. Did you have a question for Walt Wolfram?
I just had a comment. I had the privilege of working with a lawyer here in Raleigh, Billy Costin, who was from Gates County originally, but wherever we went to try cases across the state, he was able to affect the accent of the locals, which served him quite well when talking to juries. It was very interesting to see, and he meant it entirely out of respect. He loved this state and all the parts of it and all the differences, but it was just incredible to sit in a courtroom and watch him, if we were in Dare County, sound like one of the Outer Bankers or once, wherever we were.
Excellent point. I have to laugh because the first year we had moved here, my wife, who's from Philadelphia, got a speeding ticket and had to go to a rural area near Lewisburg to pay the ticket. She said, I walked in the courtroom with all the Southern lawyers and the judges. She said, I knew I was dead. That a Northerner speeding in North Carolina was not going to get Little out of that
lesson
one.
Number two is hire a Southern lawyer than to get out of the ticket,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Right. Well, Carrie, thank you for your call. Now, was he very successful at that?
He was very successful.
Yeah,
he was amazing. Excuse me.
Yeah, jurors want to hear lawyers who can relate to them. Mm-hmm. That's part of identity.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your call. And we continue our conversation with Walt Wolfram. If you want to join us, it's 1-877-962-9862. Hi there, Rosie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. Just calling, I have a comment. I was born in the Dominican Republic, but moved to New York with my family when I was 12 years old and actually learned English in New York. Then we moved to Providence, Rhode Island, so I guess my manner of speaking is very much northerner, but I've lived here for about 8.5 years now in Raleigh, North Carolina, and people down here automatically call me a Yankee, which is kind of baffling to me because I had never been called a Yankee before, but you know, and people down here just say, oh, you must be from up north, but people in New York and in Rhode Island automatically know that I was born on the island. And it's just quite interesting to me that my accent down here is automatically assumed to be a northern accent, but it's very much recognizable. It obviously must be because of the large population of islanders in New York City and in the Northeast in general.
Exactly. I mean, no one would identify you as a sort of southerner who learned English as a second language in the South, which is kind of an interesting study in its own right now. What's happening to the Latino community in North Carolina? Are they picking up southern speech? Are they remaining separate? Or are they going to be more like, people who aren't from North Carolina?
And what is happening? Is there any trend you see?
Well, it depends on individuals, and it depends. I mean, it takes a few years for these things to iron out. But there was one sort of interesting episode that one of my students who was doing field work in Siler City, she was waiting in the center of town, and a Latino gentleman in a pickup truck rolled down his window and said to her, "Wait a minute, I'm fixing to move in a minute," which is sort of like Spanish accent in English, but the totally southern term fixing to as fixing to.
Fixing to move.
Yeah.
Indeed. So Rosie, I'm curious, do you hear a difference, obviously, between the English that was spoken in New York and the English spoken here?
Oh, goodness, yes. So when I first moved down here, the company I work for is in Franklinton, North Carolina, and I had a very difficult time understanding some of the locals. And you know, I'm thinking here, okay, I've gone to college, and I know it's my second language, but I speak English pretty well. I don't know what these people are telling me.
Now, do you find yourself adopting any of the expressions from the South?
A friend of mine accused me of such at one point, born and raised in East Providence, Rhode Island, and she's married to a guy from Maine, and she actually lives in Scarborough right now. And when I want to hear New England, I call her.
Rosie, do you ever use y'all?
I've actually, and please forgive me, the natives listening, I always say that at the time I say y'all, I'm moving back up north.
Or the time you're here permanently.
several things. I mean, I play around. My sister is born and bred New Englander, and she definitely, even though she lives here now, she has a very thick New England accent, no R's at all. And when she goes home to visit, she comes back, and I'm like, whoa, you've... you know, you can tell the difference as when she's been associating with her friends. So I'm sure I've picked up certain things that I don't notice.
You probably picked up more than you realize.
But there an equivalent, though, in Spanish to ustedes, no? To y'all? Wouldn't it be one and the same? It's a plural for you.
But ustedes, you know, we use the different terms. It's more of a formal term.
And y'all is not.
And I don't think so.
The fact of the matter is virtually all dialects of English have a plural form of you. So in Philadelphia, in the north where I came from, it was yous, or you
exactly.
guys.
Yous guys.
And and in Pittsburgh and in Smoky Mountains, it's yins. And it just happens to be y'all in the South.
Correct. That's correct.
Right. Okay. Well, Rosie, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Peepa, who joins us now from Eflin. Hi there, Peepa.
Hi. My question is the phrase, I want to ask you a question. Why down in this area is it so popular to say axe?
Okay. Actually, the form axe, which tends to be associated with African-American English today, is the older pronunciation. The form ask actually came from a verb, actually came from two verbs, one of which was axion. So it was modern speakers who actually changed it into s. It's a retention, or at this point, it's become sort of associated with an ethnic group. But actually, there are lots of isolated areas in the world where English is spoken that still do, in fact, retain the term, the pronunciation of ask as axe.
Yeah. Does that answer your question, Peepa?
Sure does. Thank you.
Okay. There's another use that, and it's a diphthong, a TH, if I'm using it correctly, if I remember my phonics.
Okay.
A TH. And sometimes people will use F for that. And
particularly at the end of a syllable or the end of
a
word.
Like birthday, for
right,
birthday.
Right, birthday, yeah.
Again, associated among African Americans. Yeah. However, I have heard white North Carolinians use that. In fact, a senatorial candidate in our state used that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Somebody told me it was from the area of the state that he was from at a certain time. That was the manner of speaking.
Well, yeah, it's an older and rural form, which in North Carolina is not uniquely African American at all. It's just a rural term. If you remember Sam Irvin, you know, he was a famous bath for bath user.
Mm-hmm. And that goes. There are places in England that do that.
Oh yes,
too.
Yeah. It's quite common in areas of England and around the world where English is spoken as well.
Oh. Anne in Winston. Hi there, Anne.
Oh, hello.
Hi. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you. I just want to make two quick points. I think the Southern drawl, if I can use that term, has been over-romanticized. I, quite frankly, detest it. Born and raised in the South, moved away for 3 generations and still detest it, and have spent a lot of my life trying to outrun it. Another point is trying to teach the long and short vowel sounds to elementary children during their formative reading years. It's very difficult because children usually will repeat what it is that they hear. They won't always use the correct term, as in the word lend has a short E sound, but they hear it lend here in the South. And that's very, very confusing to first, second, and third graders when they are constantly bombarded with the Southernisms rather than what they are told to sound out as a short vowel sound.
Okay, well, two reactions. One is certainly people have likes and dislikes when it comes to dialects. I think that all dialects are wonderfully reflective of cultural differences and are to be respected and praised. Now, it is true that in reading that different dialects have different phonic associations, and so teachers or reading specialists have to take that into account. If you're going to teach reading in the South, you need to understand the particular phonics of Southern speech as it relates to letters.
Well, Walt Wolfram, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Walt Wolfram is a linguist at NC State University. His documentary film, Voices of North Carolina, will be airing statewide on North Carolina Public TV on Thursday, January 6th. That'll be happening at 10 p.m. And for today, that's the state of things. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the show, our email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.